It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to the season finale edition of the Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. Bill, I wonder if we should do like a cliffhanger like they do on some of the Netflix series to keep our listeners coming back for next season. You have anything in mind?
Well, why don't we just go all the way back to the original cliffhanger in my mind, which was Dallas. The great Dallas cliffhanger.
That's right. Who shot JR?
Yes, absolutely. Sure, why not? I think baseball lends itself to that. There will be plenty of off-season activity, so we could say which Red Sox player will return, which Red Sox player will sign with the Yankees, which Red Sox player will be traded.
Perfect. We got to get some dramatic music to go along with it, too.
We do.
So this is Bill Corey, sports editor of the Providence Journal, and that voice you heard was Bill Koch, our Red Sox writer who is transitioning into our URI basketball writer as the leaves are falling and basketball is replacing baseball. But before we let that happen, we are going to do this one final Twin Bills podcast to kind of put a bow on the season and talk about some of the things that have happened in the last 2 weeks. And there have been a few things, and I think we should probably lead off here with news of the American League MVP, which was the Red Sox's very own Mookie Betts. I guess no surprise there, right, Bill?
No. Won it in dominating fashion. He got 28 of the 30 first-place votes, and he was good value for it, Bill. I know, you know, we watch him more than maybe we watch Mike Trout during the year, or, you know, maybe a little bit more than Jose Ramirez during the year. But just to see how good Betts was in all phases of the game, at the plate, in the field, on the bases, I really thought he was outstanding. This is probably the maximum of what you could ask for and expect of a player. He was just wonderful from start to finish.
Yeah, he really was. And you know, obviously, people will look at this season and say J.D. Martinez was also a big factor in the Red Sox success, and he absolutely was. Kind of tailed off a little bit at the end of the year, and I think it just speaks to how hard it is for a DH to win an MVP, because obviously he doesn't bring anything defensively to the table, whereas Mookie was outstanding defensively. But I know there was a little bit of an uproar because JD was not one of the finalists for MVP. What did you think about that? I sat here all we both sat here all summer long saying how important he was to the team. And he absolutely was. I don't know. I wasn't that upset that he wasn't on the finalist list, because I think he did kind of tail off, and I couldn't argue with the people who that were listed as finalists.
You know, oddly enough, he did get one of the other two first place votes. Mike Trout got the 30th. Mm-hmm. There's going to be an inherent bias there with J.D. Martinez, just as there would be with a pitcher who you might like to nominate for the MVP award. Voters will say that J.D. Martinez only plays half the game. He only hits. He does not play defense. And that's, you know, something that's going to be held against him. It's certainly something that's reflected in his WAR numbers, wins above replacement, whereas Mookie Betts gets a huge boost in that category because of how good he is defensively. The folks who don't want to vote for pitchers for MVP will say they only play once every 5 days. Right. So there's always going to be that sort of bias against Martinez. I think actually it was David Price was right what he said. Probably with a month or so left in the year, he said Mookie Betts is the MVP of the league and J.D. Martinez is the MVP of the Red Sox, just because of the way he transformed the lineup. But everyone knows, and I think the players know as well, the way the voting is going to go down. People are going to look at wins above replacement, and they're going to look for the total player. There's going to be that bias against the DH. J.D. did finish fourth in the voting, and you know, you certainly could have argued for third ahead of Jose Ramirez, who had a difficult last 2 months. Right. But I don't necessarily see how you would get him any higher than that, just knowing the way the voters think a little bit.
Well, I guess that we could chalk this up to a first world problem, right?
That's right.
You know,
That's right.
Having two guys that are in the discussion for MVP on a team that wins 108 games and goes on to win the World Series. You know, you can only get so worked up about it if the other guy isn't one of the finalists.
As we know, though, Red Sox fans will get worked up.
Sure.
You could see that in our emails and social media interactions. You know, and they have every right. And you know, I don't necessarily blame them if they watch J.D. Martinez play every night, because he was a sensational hitter.
Fantastic.
This year.
He really was, yeah. And in a lot of ways transformed that lineup and helped, I think, other guys have the kind of years they had as well. So another bit of news that happened in the last couple of weeks is that Alex Cora finished second in the Manager of the Year voting for the American League, and soon after that was rewarded, not so much for the Manager of the Year voting, but obviously for what he did in the dugout, was rewarded with a new contract. I think that sounds about fair, don't you think?
Well, I think it's a reflection of two things. First, obviously, the job that he did this year. When you win a franchise record 108 games, you win the World Series, and you know, more importantly, you're the face of the organization, like he was. Mm. So accessible, so calm, you know, so presentable in that way. He's exactly what they could have asked for in a manager. He played the role perfectly. So certainly they're rewarding his job performance there. I think it's also a reflection of the original contract that he had. As a first-time manager, he was one of the lowest-paid guys in the league. You add a year, you get him through 2021, you add a club option for 2022. The financial terms are undisclosed, but you can assume that he got a healthy raise in there. And it was well-deserved. I mean, we said it, you know, pretty much on every podcast that we had here. Just the job that he did and the effect that he had on this group, it was so noticeable.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say he didn't take a pay cut, that's for sure.
No,
and, it was a little surprising to me that he was so low on the pay scale, not because he was a first-year manager, but because it's the Red Sox.
Sure.
You know, and the Red Sox clearly, you know, they have the biggest payroll in baseball. They're not known for being skimpy, usually. You know, certainly he wasn't going to command the top salary for a manager, but you know, I think the Red Sox certainly got their money's worth and more out of a first-year manager, Alex Cora.
No question. You know, and you reference a Manager of the Year voting there. Bob Melvin, obviously, of Oakland, was the winner. And I tweeted this at the time when the votes were released. I just think that the Manager of the Year now has become the overachiever of the year. You know, somebody like Bob Melvin has the lowest payroll in the league. He gets Oakland into that sort of wild card playoff game there against the Yankees. People will look and they'll say they spent X million and won 96 games. The Red Sox spent X million and won 108 games. Cora, quote unquote, should win. Melvin, quote unquote, shouldn't win. So I think a lot of that is reflected in the voting, and I think it's going to be very difficult for the Red Sox manager or the Yankees manager or the Astros manager to win Manager of the Year because of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely true. There's a huge bias against the big market team managers. And you know, I can see both sides of that. You spend the highest amount of money on payroll in baseball. There's an expectation that goes along with that. And so when you meet that expectation, people sort of shrug and say, well, you were supposed to do that. But we know it's not that easy.
That's right.
I mean, Red Sox are typically among the highest spenders in baseball, and they don't go to the World Series every year, and they don't win the World Series every year. Neither do the New York Yankees. And the fact that he took a team that couldn't get out of the first round, could barely win in the first round in the last couple of years, and you know, really marched through the playoffs, losing only one game per series, I think speaks a lot about his ability to lead, to manage, to communicate, all the things that we've heard the players talk about all season long. And look, I don't think he's losing any sleep over the fact that he didn't get Manager of the Year.
No.
I think he got the prize that he wanted to get.
Yeah, you know, if the voting was done after the playoffs, I certainly think he would have won it. You know, unfortunately for Cora, the voting is done before the playoffs start. Just to give every manager an equal opportunity, they all get 162 games to state their case. You could have someone be the Manager of the Year who doesn't make the postseason, in theory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but even with all that said, you had a 15-win improvement. Yes, you added J.D. Martinez, but to win the way that they did during the regular season, to win 108 games, we've talked about this, to win two-thirds of your games against fellow professionals doesn't happen. It's such an anomaly, and you know, to do it the way they did it, to not lose four straight at any point, they were the only team to do that, it just spoke to their consistency, and I think when a team is that consistent and that good for so long, that definitely speaks to their leadership.
Absolutely, and it's that leadership that extended his contract by one more year. They have him there through 2021, and there's a team option for a year after that, too. So, you know, he puts together another year or two similar to this past year. I bet you that the Red Sox are going to pick that up again, or they may rip up the contract and give him a new one with more money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So let's take a look at some of the decisions that Dave Dombrowski has in front of him here as he gets ready for the 2019 season. Chief among them, of course, are the free agent decisions, some of which have already been made. You know, David Price will be back. Chris Sale is coming back.
Eduardo Nunez.
Nunez will return. Right. Nunez will return. So let's take a look at some of the question marks here, Bill. Nathan Eovaldi, Joe Kelly, Craig Kimbrell. What's your scouting report here on these guys?
Well, we had a conference call with Dave Dombrowski and Steve Pierce on Monday, who's also coming back.
Right, Pierce. Yep.
Signed a one-year deal to return for the same money that he made last year, $6.25 million, and said pretty much that he didn't really put himself on the market, that this was the place that he wanted to be. He was comfortable here. For anyone who saw him in the clubhouse after his acquisition in late June from Toronto, he was at home right away. Took to the other players very quickly. You know, Steve Pierce is a very sort of down-to-earth, good guy, good professional, someone who you would imagine would fit in with any group, and someone who, you know, I think they did a good job to keep. He and Mitch Moreland to both signed through 2019. It stands to reason that they'll platoon at first base. And then the following year, you might see Michael Chavis or Bobby Dalbec or Josh Ockamy maybe get a chance. The Red Sox might be able to save some money at that position for somewhat equal production and maybe allocate that money to Mookie Betts or Xander Bogaerts for extensions. I think that's probably long-term what they have in mind. I think that's probably why Pierce only got 1 year. Dombrowski did address some free agents in that call. Chief among them, obviously, Eovaldi and Joe Kelly. And Craig Kimbrell. Those are the three guys who you would expect them to want to bring back. I think Eovaldi probably more so than the other two. Kimbrell, I think they understand, is probably going to get 3, 4, 5 years somewhere else at about $16, $17 million a year. That's what the market is. That's what Wade Davis gets paid and Aroldis Chapman gets paid. And I don't necessarily think that the Red Sox are going to commit that much to Kimbrell. In terms of Eovaldi, I was actually out to dinner with my brother the other night, and he asked me, he said, what do you think they're going to do with Eovaldi? And I said, it's fascinating because no one really knows what his market is going to be. And yeah, you don't necessarily want to overpay if right, you're the Red Sox or any other team. But, I mean, realistically, any contract offers presented to him could be the widest range that I could remember.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at his career arc, you know, he was a decent pitcher. But he was just fantastic in the postseason, obviously, and he had some very dominant starts in the in the regular season for the Red Sox as well. So you're right. You don't know where those numbers are going to come in. I don't think the Red Sox are going to overpay for somebody like that.
Sure.
And there may be another team out there seeing what he's done in the postseason that may overpay. So I'm a little unsure about Eovaldi. Whereas I don't think Kimbrell is coming back.
Yes.
And Joe Kelly is kind of falls in the middle for me.
He's an intriguing one, Kelly, only because if another club envisions him as a closer, automatically he gets paid a little more. He's right, going to get paid in the closer bracket instead of the middle relief bracket. You know, so whether or not the Red Sox would want to, you maybe sort of extend themselves financially for a guy who at times during the regular season really struggled. Mm-hmm. At times he was really good. In the postseason, he was really good. So Kelly is the type of guy, as we've seen here in Boston, who you're going to have to ride the roller coaster a little bit. Are they content with doing that, or would they rather, you know, go in a different direction, maybe with some of their younger guys, maybe move, you know, Ryan Brazier and Matt Barnes, keep them in those high-leverage roles, you know, maybe bring up someone from the minors like Travis Lakins or Mike Schuwaren, who might be able to pitch out of the bullpen for this team. You know, maybe Lakins in particular, I think, is just about ready and, you know, is likely to be added to the 40-man roster to protect him from the Rule 5 draft. Those selections will be announced later on Tuesday. But you know, you're also doing a financial balance here, obviously. If you overpay for Kimbrell or you overpay for Kelly, in this case, you might not be able to sign Betts or Bogarts or Sale or Porcello. So the, the Red Sox are sort of, they're walking the tightrope here a little bit in terms of finances and the luxury tax.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of this depends on what happens to Kimbrel. I don't think he's coming back, so I think you're right. I think that they look inward first, and does Brazier step into the closer's role? Does Matt Barnes? Or does Joe Kelly, you know?
Right.
You know, you could point to innings that Kelly has pitched this past season and the postseason and say, perfect closer, but yet we know enough because we've seen those other innings that he's pitched where you would just, you know, you would want anybody but Joe Kelly on the mound in those high leverage situations. But again, you know, do you go with what you last saw with Kelly, or do you go with what you know a full body of a full season of Kelly is?
And I think a lot of that is going on with Evaldi too. You know, just is he going to be the guy who, you know, maybe was sort of off and on during the regular season? He was really good against the Yankees a few times, really good against the Twins, I think it was his first start. But he had a couple other starts where he was bad. Against the Phillies, he struggled. Against Baltimore, he struggled. His career track record isn't necessarily that great. The other thing is, he's 28 years old. Is he looking for 5 or 6 years right now? Or does he want, say, a two-year deal and then hit free agency again when he's 30, 31? Just the options there, I feel like that's going to cause him to drag at least into the winter meetings in December, if not well after, only because I could just see him getting such a wide range of offers to have to decide.
And just to touch on a couple of other names here before we leave free agency here. Ian Kinsler and Drew Pomeranz. So what are we hearing and thinking?
Yesterday, Dombrowski mentioned second base as probably the only position where the Red Sox really have any question marks going into spring training next year. They bring back just about everybody else. And, you know, they're obviously waiting on Dustin Pedroia. He was working out with the team throughout the playoffs, taking ground balls, taking batting practice. No further surgery planned at this time. He's going to rest and rehab and go through therapy and then maybe start running again in January. They want to push that back as far as they can just to ensure that they don't have any setbacks right before spring training. They still plan on Pedroia playing second base for them next year. He's under contract through 2021. No one is taking that money in a trade. So, like it or not, they're stuck with each other and they need to try to make it work. Mm-hmm. You know, behind him, obviously, you have Brock Holt as an alternative. You could play Eduardo Nunez there. He struggles defensively at second base, but he is someone you could put there. Zhu Weilin had a decent year in the minor leagues last year and is somebody who, you know, potentially you could see as that utility guy this year or next year once Holt hits free agency. So he's an option. Marco Hernandez is another guy who we'll see if he can get healthy. He's obviously had multiple shoulder surgeries. Dombrowski said he'll start next year in the minor leagues. He's someone who always intrigued me because he's a decent fielder and he has decent power to his pull side. He's someone who would be an okay addition to a lineup. But for right now, I don't necessarily think that Ian Kinsler is in their plans, and I don't necessarily think that Drew Pomeranz will be either. In terms of the starting rotation for next year, you're looking at Sale, Price, Porcello, Rodriguez, and then any one of Wright, Velasquez, Johnson, or Evaldi if you bring him back. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's not such a bad thing because, for the most part, you're bringing back the same team, you know, minus a guy here or there. And if they can get the closers role ironed out, then, you know, you've got a team that just won 108 games and won the World Series. It's not a bad idea to bring them all back if you can.
Sure.
It's what happens after next year, I think, will be very interesting because then you've got a lot of big names kind of coming up.
That's right. In the 2020, you've got Porcello, Sale, Bogarts, Moreland, Pierce, Holt, Thornburg, all those guys, and Nunez. All those guys will be free agents.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, then you get into 21, and obviously you're going to have Betts, Bradley. You know, it's going to be another really you know, strong class just with those two.
Right. So probably one more season of very familiar faces, then sort of it'll be you know, a bit of a lottery. We'll see what happens.
Well, it's going to be a lot of turnover, and you wonder, you know, are you going to try to trade some of these players with 1 year left on their contract? Are any of your guys from the minor league system going to be ready by that point. Is a Jay Groom going to show up, or a Michael Chavis going to show up, or you know, anyone who you're sort of developing right now? Obviously, Dave Dombrowski's made some trades. He's moved some minor leaguers on. They have a lot of guys who are lower in the system, whether it be in rookie ball or in A or just pushing double A, who might be among their more talented players, mm-hmm. but they're not necessarily ready to show up in Boston yet. You have to see them develop and sort of climb the ranks here and see if they might be able to give you some low-cost alternatives. If you look at what the Yankees have done really the last couple of years, when they decided they weren't going to be in contention a couple of years ago and they were able to trade Aroldis Chapman and Andrew Miller, sort of rebuild their system with a few deals. You look what they have on the field now in terms of Gleyber Torres and Aaron Hicks and Aaron Judge, and you know, I'm missing several guys, but it's Luis Severino. It's very impressive the way that they've turned over their roster and the way that they've put themselves in financial position like they are now.
And it really didn't seem to take that long for them either.
Didn't
seem like they had maybe a season or two where they were a bit down, but hey, this year they won over 100 games and were in the postseason. So it'll be interesting because, you know, with the success of the Red Sox and the demands of Boston, you know, I don't think fans are really into the rebuilding mode of Boston teams.
They do reloading. They don't
reloading,
do rebuilding.
Right. We don't rebuild. They reload.
They don't
right.
do that.
Right. So when the Red Sox made the final out in the World Series and won the championship this year, our headline the next day on the sports section was the best ever. And, you know, clearly this is the best Red Sox team statistically,
yes.
having won the number of games they've won. You know, they polished it off with a World Series championship. And so we're going to get into what I like to call list radio, even though it's not radio, it's the podcast, but it's sort of like radio. But, you know, when hosts have nothing to talk about, they start ranking the best players of all time, the best teams of all time. So we're going to indulge ourselves a little bit here as we are putting the Twin Bills to bed for the season and talk a little bit about the best Red Sox team ever. So here are the parameters. So I'm the boss, so I get to make the parameters.
Absolutely.
Okay? So the parameters are, we have to be talking about teams that win the World Series.
Yes.
Now, I fully understand that there are other great Red Sox teams, 75, 78, 67, even 86 was a great team. But, you know, those teams did not win the World Series.
Yes.
So ultimately, I cannot rank them as the greatest Red Sox teams ever.
No, you're absolutely right.
And
they weren't the best team in baseball.
That's right.
Given year.
You have to win the World Series. So, and the other parameter that I'm going to lay down here is that we are talking about the modern day Red Sox and not the teams that won the World Series back in the 19-teens. And I do that because, number one, you and I are not that old and we don't really remember those teams specifically.
Sure.
And, you know, it was a different era. Obviously, it was segregated baseball. I don't think that you and I could really talk about intelligently how great those teams were in comparison to other teams.
No, in fairness, you would have to do post-Jackie Robinson. I think that's right. You know, post-war, late 40s on, I think when you're having the greatest team of all time discussions, I think it's probably the most fair that you start right around there. And really, if you wanted to get even more modern and a little more micro, you could go from, say, mid-60s on when Hispanic players started to come
That's
into
true.
The league, whether
That's
it be
true.
Clemente or Tony Oliva or, you know, other guys from the Latin countries who started to come in.
Juan Marichal. And,
you know, you look at the All-Star game this year, and I think you had 21 different nations represented.
Yeah, it was fantastic. You know, a truly diverse sport.
So you're looking at now, current baseball now, there is talent in the major leagues from literally all over the world. Mm-hmm. So you can't, I agree with you, you can't necessarily go back to like the 1912 Red Sox when they had Smokey Joe Wood and Tris Speaker. Great players in their era, certainly.
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
But
right.
they weren't necessarily playing against the best players available.
Right, right. Well, as so happens, the Red Sox make it easy on us because all of their championships happened in the last 14 years.
That's right.
So we can limit our discussions to the four World Series championship Red Sox teams of this century. And just right off the bat, and you can tell me if you disagree, but I would just throw the 2013 team kind of off that list. Now, that was a great feel-good story. It was the Boston Marathon bombing year.
Yeah.
It was the Boston Strong. It was John Farrell's first year as the Red Sox manager. There were a lot of feel-good storylines there, and it was a wonderful surprise that they ended up winning the World Series. But to be fair, I cannot look at that team and say that they are the best Red Sox team of all time.
It was a different year from the standpoint that it felt like a lot of it was slapped together with bubblegum and duct
right.
tape. You had a lot of sort of veteran guys like Shane Victorino or Johnny Gomes who were brought in for a very specific purpose on short-term deals to try and stabilize the team after the disaster that was Bobby Valentine. And it just so happened that it came together in a way.
Yeah.
You look at the series that they played. I mean, beating Detroit in the ALCS, offensively, they were horrendous, with the exception of a grand slam by David Ortiz
right.
and a grand slam by Shane Victorino.
Right.
In the World Series, you know, they weren't that great there either.
Right.
You had a Johnny Gomes three-run homer off Seth Maness, which I think was probably the biggest hit of the series, in my mind.
Mm.
It sort of put the Red Sox in control. But that's not one of those teams that you're going to look and say, there were all-time great Red Sox on that team. You know, multiple guys. There might have been one or two, but
sure.
You know, it wasn't going to be populated by a guy who had an all-time great season for the Red Sox or, you know, something like that. David Ortiz was wonderful. He dominated through the playoffs.
He carried the team, no doubt.
You know, Dustin Pedroia at times was very good on that team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that was not. I would rank that as probably the worst of the four
of
championship
four.
Teams
yeah.
in this century.
So that leaves us with the 04 team, the 07 team, and then this year, the 2018 Red Sox.
Yep.
For those of us who have been longtime Red Sox fans, as both of us have been, the 04 team holds a special place in our hearts.
Absolutely.
To do what no team had ever done in our lifetime, in the lifetime of our parents, and even the lifetime of some of our grandparents, and the way they did it. Certainly coming back down 0-3 to the Yankees of all teams in the ALCS, winning it, and then just cruising through the World Series. I don't think emotionally we could ever love a team more if you were a Red Sox fan than probably that team, because of having lost the way they lost the previous year, coming back and winning it in that fashion. But for my money, I would say that I would not rank them as the greatest Red Sox team ever. Now, I would certainly say they are the greatest Red Sox story ever. You know, from our standpoint as journalists, they were fantastic to cover, to do what they have done. But if you could magically put them on the field against the other two teams, to me, the 07 team and the 18 team were better teams.
Yeah, the 04 team sort of liberated us in a way. They allowed us to actually think that good things could happen.
Yeah.
When it came to the Red Sox.
Right, because all of our lives we were conditioned that it's just going to fall apart at the end.
It was almost nine decades of gloom and doom and despair. You know, you got to the last game of a series or the last inning of a clinching game, and you were still waiting for something to happen, for that other shoe to drop, mm-hmm. for something terrible like in 86 against the Mets where you won strike away. And, you know, obviously what happened is what happened. I'm not going to get into it.
Right.
I'm not going to have...
it didn't end well.
I'm not going to induce any post-traumatic stress among our listeners. But that 04 team, I think, you know, in terms of those guys, just the way that they battled the Yankees in the last four games just so desperately, David Ortiz having two walk-off hits, a home run off Paul Quantrill, and then a single off Esteban Loaiza to get it back to Yankee Stadium.
Yep.
And then in Game 6, they started to get some calls, which I could not believe at the time, and I actually thought when Mark Bellhorn's homer got overruled and they turned it from a ground rule double into a homer, and then when the A-Rod slap of Bronson Arroyo got overruled and they called A-Rod out, at that point I actually started to think this might happen.
Yeah,
because finally they got a couple breaks where, as in previous years, those calls certainly would have been wrong and they would have been held against Boston and they
right.
never would have been overturned. And then in Game 7, obviously, to jump out the way they did on the Yankees and then to you know, ride through the World Series, it was phenomenal. But, you know, I just think that that season in particular, you had Pedro Martinez sort of not what he was like in 99, 2000.
He was a little bit past his prime, for sure.
Curt Schilling was great.
Absolutely.
Throughout the year.
Yeah.
Was nails in the playoffs.
Really only had
the one bad start in game two in Yankee Stadium where he was clearly hurt. To come back the way he did in game six and then in his World Series start was phenomenal. But behind them, you had Tim Wakefield, Derek Lowe, and Bronson Arroyo were your three primary starters. Not necessarily guys who you would think would cut their way through opposing lineups in a way. Derek Lowe was great that postseason, but I certainly think that other Red Sox teams have had better rotations than sure. those guys. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of the lineup, it was pretty good.
The middle of that lineup was historically
Manny good. And Ortiz, sure. obviously, are carrying that lineup. And Jason Varitek was a very good hitter that season as well. Yeah. Had an .872 OPS as a catcher, which was very solid. But jumping to 07 and jumping to this year's team, obviously, we need to remind some folks about 07. That team, you had probably the back end of Manny Ramirez. He was 35 by that point, but still an impact bat in the middle of the lineup. David Ortiz squarely in his prime. Mike Lowell had a terrific season that year as the throw-in in the Josh Beckett trade. Mm-hmm. Kevin Youkilis was coming into his own by that point. Dustin Pedroia had a good year. That was a really, really strong lineup. And then you look at the pitching staff. Josh Beckett was a true ace. Curt Schilling still had a little bit. Tim Wakefield still had a little bit. And Daisuke Matsuzaka came over and gave you 200 innings.
Yeah, he actually had a good season that year. It wasn't
had
it,
a good year.
He didn't live up to the hype, but he certainly had a good year.
And then you go into the bullpen, and Jonathan Papelbon just emerged to superstardom that year as a 26-year-old. Was just a lights-out closer, guy who could throw multiple innings, could throw against anybody in any situation. And Hideki Okajima was one of the great surprises from my money.
Yeah.
Sort of like a throw-in signing, like kind of to give Daisuke a buddy, almost. somebody to sort of go through it together coming over from Japan.
But no, he was very
good. And performed at an all-star level.
Yeah.
So realistically, that 07 team posting the same record that this team did in the playoffs, going 11-3.
Yeah.
I thought
they won 101 games in the regular season.
Yeah, I thought they were super. I think it is a two-team discussion between them and 2018.
Right. So I'm going to surprise you here and tell you why I think this team, the one that just won the World Series, is the greatest team of all time.
Okay.
And I certainly respect the 07 team, and they were a wire-to-wire team. They were a wagon, absolutely. But I would say this about this team. They were never in trouble in the postseason. Not one time were they in trouble. And in both the 04 and 07 teams, it got a little hairy there. Obviously, 04 with the ALCS against the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
Red Sox had no business winning that series. They obviously did, historic.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, things got a little hairy in Cleveland, against Cleveland in 07. Thank you, J.D. Drew, very much. But, it looked like that road was going to end there, right?
You're down 3-1 in Cleveland.
Yep.
And you were fortunate enough to have Josh Beckett going in game 5.
Right.
And you were fortunate enough that Cleveland decided to bring out his ex-girlfriend to sing the national anthem. Probably not a great idea. When Josh Beckett turns to the pitching coach in the bullpen and says, "For the record, I dumped her." You think he was locked in? You think he was ready to go out there and shove it on the Indians?
Absolutely.
Probably a little bit.
Yeah.
And Boston obviously carried that into game 6 and game 7. But your point is a good one. They were down 3-1.
And this year's team, obviously everybody points to the 108 regular season wins. Phenomenal accomplishment. But, as you and I have said many times over the course of this summer, there were some bad teams in the league this year. And, maybe that those 108 wins were a little padded. Maybe they were more like a 100-win team or whatever. But to me, you had a team with the MVP on the roster,
mm-hmm.
and when the games counted the most, as they do in the playoffs, the Red Sox really didn't have the. I mean, they had some drama, but if you let's just quickly recap here: the first series against the Yankees, they win the first game, they lose the second game, they shift to New York, and everybody's thinking, including me, like, here we go. You know, the Yankees did what they had to do.
Severino's throwing game three.
They tied it up. We're going to New York and blah, blah, blah. Nope. It was over. Two games later, Red Sox are dancing on the field. The Yankees never got back into that. I mean, they tied it, obviously, but they never were able to really make a series out of it.
Yep.
Houston, they lose the first game. And you and I sat here and said before that series, this is probably where the Red Sox road ends.
Well, I thought Houston was the best team in baseball.
Absolutely.
I thought it was more about the Astros than it was about the Red Sox.
Exactly. And not to take away from the Red Sox, but the Astros are the defending World Series champion. Very complete team. They seem to be gelling at the right time. Bregman looked like a beast.
Mm-hmm.
You're thinking, okay, well, you know, as great as the Red Sox are this year, this is the team that's probably going to beat them because they're a little bit better in every facet.
Yes.
Sure enough, they lose the first game. Red Sox lose the first game. And you're thinking, okay, well, this is, you know, the Red Sox will probably make a, at least I'm thinking, they'll probably make a series out of this, but Houston's going to win this, right? The Red Sox didn't lose another game to Houston.
Right.
You know, they ran off four in a row. Think about how hard that is in the postseason, especially when two of those wins are in the opponent's building.
Houston had been 10-1 at home and lost three in a row to the Red Sox.
Right. And you know, and finally, once they get to the World Series, I think we all agreed that the Red Sox should beat the Dodgers.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I thought it was going to be a longer series, and it had the potential there, as we talked about in one of the previous podcasts, when Puig hit that home run
in game four, and the
Dodgers went up, was it 4-0?
4-0.
At that point, I'm thinking, okay, well, now this is going to go 6 or 7 games. This is going to be a series. And the Red Sox battled right back, ended up winning that game. By then, they go up, 3-1 at that point?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, polish it off. So, to me, battling back, winning those games, and essentially not letting the other team even sniff a victory in the postseason speaks a lot about how good your team is. And I think we can point to particular players on 04 and 07 and say, this person had a better year than this person. This third baseman was better than this third baseman. Absolutely. But as we know in sports, you know, it doesn't matter what the matchups and what it says on paper. That's why they play the games, right? And I think that this team, when the chips were down, they always responded. You know, there was always that glimmer of doubt. Oh, gee, maybe here's where the series is going to turn. And it wasn't just that they figured out how to win the next game. They just ended the series after that. And I think a lot of that goes to Alex Cora and the way he managed. And as you brought up before, he had that killer instinct. You know, when he saw an opening, he went after it. He didn't say he wasn't playing for the tie, so to speak. You know, he was playing to win that game.
I think the incredible thing about this team, and I think your points are very well made, they won the three games in the playoffs that they absolutely had to have.
Right.
Game 3 at Yankee Stadium, Game 4 at Minute Maid Park, Game 4 at Dodger Stadium. If they lose any one of those three games, those series turn completely.
Absolutely. The tenor changes.
You know, and I just look at the way that they did it, the completeness of the team. They won Game 3 in Yankee Stadium because of Brock Holt, who hit for the cycle. They won Game 4 in Houston on a 2-run homer by Jackie Bradley, who had hit a grand slam the night before, who had hit a 3-run double the night before. Dodger Stadium in Game 4, they win it on a 3-run homer by Mitch Moreland, a homer and a 3-run double by Steve Pierce.
Yep, it was a true team effort. It wasn't David Ortiz hitting grand slams every game.
You haven't heard me say Mookie Betts yet,
right,
or J.D. Martinez yet, or Xander Bogaerts yet. Those guys were there under the surface. You won the World Series with Chris Sale getting 15 outs.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
In 5 games.
Yeah, David Price stepped up big time.
You had David Price and Nathan Eovaldi and, you know, to maybe a little lesser extent, Eduardo Rodriguez come through. Eovaldi and Rodriguez in games where they were on the hook and would have lost. Eovaldi did lose Game 3. Rodriguez would have lost Game 4.
Yeah.
But gave them innings that maybe allowed them to set up everything else and sort of sustain and maintain. Just the completeness of this team, I think, is probably what puts them over the top. I think that's what you're trying to get at, and I think you're absolutely right. They just got contributions from everyone on the roster. There was no one here who you would look at and say, well, this guy's kind of along for the ride. The closest you might get to that would have been, you know, maybe Blake Swihart, who didn't really get to play that much in the postseason.
Right.
But he stepped in at critical times during the year when Christian Vasquez was hurt, when he had the broken finger. He was playing a lot in those games. Had an 11-game hitting streak at one point. The pitching staff, you're looking at someone like Pomeranz, who struggled but was still in the rotation early in the year and took his turn. It was just such a complete team, and I think Cora fostered that. He was able to get good performances out of so many different guys, and all of that showed up in the postseason when they absolutely had to have those three critical games. They won all three of them.
Yeah. Well, as always, it's a good discussion to have, right? I think you could legitimately make the case for these three teams as being the greatest Red Sox team of all time, and it's a nice problem to have, trying to figure out which one is the greatest one when you just win a World Series. So, Bill, first of all, thank you. I think we had a lot of fun this summer and fall with the Twin Bills podcast. It was a great year to do it. That's for sure. You know, we will be doing it again when springtime rolls around, and we'll get a chance to look at the 2019 Red Sox. What are you going to do with all this time on your hands now?
I'm not going to take any time.
No, that's right. That's right. You refuse to take time off.
No. I took a little bit of time off. I went to Texas after the season and sort of mellowed out on the Riverwalk in San Antonio for 4 or 5 days. It's a wonderful place. I highly recommend for any of our listeners. If you're looking for a vacation and some great food and some very nice people and some beautiful scenery, that's a good place to go. Very vibrant city, live music everywhere. It's a lot of fun. Texas isn't just Austin, which would also be a great vacation spot. I'll jump back into URI basketball and locals here. You know, whether that's other college hoops, high schools, whatever it may be. That's what I was doing before I was put on the Red Sox beat. It's something I'm very comfortable doing and something I look forward to. You know, it's like I tell people all the time. They ask, what do you like covering best? And I say, anything that's well played.
Right.
I don't necessarily care what level it is or what sport it is. I want something that's intense and played with some passion. And, you know, postseason baseball provides that. Red Sox Orioles in May does not.
Right.
You know, that's not always a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You know, but you push through because you do those things to set up the great things. And I think, you know, any coach, manager, great athlete would tell you that they go through the process and it's day by day. And it's no different when you talk about what we do. You know, so I certainly will be monitoring any off-season moves that the Red Sox make, you know, and jumping in on some notes from there. But, you know, otherwise, sort of shifting focus elsewhere for now.
Great, and we'll be looking forward to reading all of that stuff. And before we sign off, I should just let our listeners know that for you podcast fans, there is another really good podcast that Bill Koch takes part in. It is called The Pick and Pop Podcast with Kevin McNamara, and they break down the local college basketball scene, heavy on PC and URI, a little bit of Brown and Bryant, as well as talking a little bit about the national scene. So keep up with them on their Twitters and as well as ProvidenceJournal.com. Bill, it's been a pleasure. We will do this when the weather starts getting nice again.
Oh, same here, Bill. Really enjoyed it this year and looking forward to next season already.
Great.